Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast channeling to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to director, actor, writer, producer, and pop-up bar proprietor, Graham Skipper. As you can tell, Graham is a man with a lot of strings to his bow, and we get into all of them. Off the bat, we start talking about the Rated R Speakeasy, which is Graham's horror-themed pop-up bar. Specifically, we talk about the event that he was putting on at Cinepocalypse in June in aid of the new Child's Play movie, but we also chat about what inspired him to set it up and what you can expect at a Rated R night. We also chat a lot about Graham's latest directorial effort, Sequence Break. Plus, we talk to Graham about his acting career and why he likes working with certain directors, particularly Joe Bagos, who he has starred in all three of Joe's features so far, and is also going to be starring in his fourth feature, VFW, which is currently in post-production. On that, UK fans may want to note that Graham will be in attendance at this year's Arrows Fright Fest, which happens this weekend, in support of Joe Bagos' latest picture, the vampire flick Bliss, which I've heard good things about from other festivals. All in all, it's a great chat. We go over all aspects of Graham's career, and I can't wait for you to listen, listener. But first, I would like to remind you, as I always do, how grateful we would be if you could rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, Radio Public. You can also just check us out wherever good podcasts are available. Now, though, here is Graham.
Hi, Graham. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So, yes, normally I would introduce the guest and then say that we're here to talk about the latest film, but you have many, many projects on the go. So I think, to start, because Cinepocalypse is just a couple of weeks away, we'll start with your Rated R Speakeasy horror bar that you do.
Rated R. It's a new venture for me and my partners, Justin and Melissa Meyer. That started a couple months ago in early March. I was walking my dog, and I was thinking to myself, man, I really wish that LA had a horror bar, you know, where everybody in the horror community could go to go hang out, that played horror music, that played horror movies, that was all decked out, and that, you know, you didn't have to wait for Halloween season to you know, go to some place that was themed for horror. And so my friends who I've known for many years, you know, they're horror designers themselves, and they had this amazing warehouse venue. And I called them and said, "What if we teamed up and tried to do this?" And they liked it, and so we set a date and just decided, well, you know, we'll see if a few people want to show up, and maybe it'll be a fun time. And we had like 600 people show. So it was clear to us that this was something that other people in the horror community wanted, and that this was something that was needed. So yeah, we just did another one here in LA last Saturday, and coming up in about a week at Cinepocalypse in Chicago, we're doing a version of it up there for the festival, where we're working with Orion Pictures and are building a themed Child's Play pop-up bar at the Music Box Theater. So we're in the thick of planning and designing for that, and it's going to be really fun. You know, we're all about building a space where horror fans can get together and be in a place that's you know, safe to celebrate this weird genre that we all love. I'm really excited to be working with Orion on this new version of Chucky that they've created, and to try to bring that to Cinepocalypse. It's going to be really, really fun. I'm very excited to get up there.
And how did that come about? Did Orion Pictures just reach out to you? And same with the Cinepocalypse thing. Did they just hear about your...
They just heard about it, you know. In Josh up at Cinepocalypse, he reached out to me. I mean, I've known him for several years now. In fact, I think maybe I met him at Fright Fest. I'm not exactly sure. But anyway, I've known Josh for years, and, you know, Sequence Break played Cinepocalypse a couple years ago. And yeah, he had just seen me posting about Rated R and reached out and said, do you guys think that you'd want to do this? And we said yes. And he sort of threw out the idea of maybe Orion, you know, coming in and doing something to help us, you know, to sort of team up for this Child's Play thing. And Orion was game, and everything worked out well, and it's just been super fun. I mean, the people at Cinepocalypse are great, and that's a really fantastic festival. They got what we're trying to do, and we're just happy to be able to have a reason to bring Rated R to places that aren't just LA, to try to spread it far and wide.
And what's the kind of sights and sounds that people can expect at a Rated R night?
Gosh. The sounds are, you know, it's all music from horror movies. So you could expect everything from, you know, low-key, synthy John Carpenter scores to more famous needle drops like Cry Little Sister or even I think at the last one, MC Hammer's The Addams Family song played. You know, so a wide variety of music, but it's all horror themed or from a horror film. At these ones in LA, we tend to do a screening, like Shudder let us do a sneak preview screening of their film Boar, which is out today actually, on Shudder. It's really fantastic. So typically we do a screening, and you know, we have a full bar. We have aerial bartenders, which are aerial acrobats that are suspended from overhead, and they pour you a drink from above, and that's really fun. We have a video arcade full of all horror-themed arcade games and pinball machines. We have an artist's alley with local horror artists that display and sell their artwork, which is something very important to us, to be able to promote, you know, local artists like that. And we have horror movies playing all night on all sorts of different screens everywhere. And it's really just a home for horror fans. The other fun thing is we have monsters that are roaming the crowd. So you're never totally safe. but that's kind of what a Rated R night is like. You know, it's a party, and it's a bar, and it's a screening, and, you know, it's an immersive experience. So it's kind of all of those things.
That sounds awesome. Yeah, I wish we had something like that out here in Scotland. That would be great.
That would sure be nice. Yeah, I mean, believe me, there's a part of my heart that is always in Scotland, and one of my great dreams would be to be able to bring Rated R out there. So if you guys know of anyone that wants to help get us out there, then yeah, we'd love to come out to Scotland and throw a big party.
Well, yeah, we should make that happen somehow. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Great.
We're going to have the two main horror festivals here, the Dead by Dawn in Edinburgh and Glasgow Fright Fest in Glasgow, obviously. I'm sure one of them would be more than happy to have
that you. Would be a dream, total dream.
You mentioned your movie... Sequence Break. I was going to ask. So that came out last year, and it's available on Shudder. So tell us a little bit about that. How you came up with the kind of concept for Sequence Break?
Yeah, Sequence Break. You know, the idea sort of started gestating. I mean, many years ago, back when I was in college, like maybe 15 years ago or something like that. where I had read an urban legend online about a supposedly haunted video game called Polybius. And this urban legend, you know, had a lot of different variations on it, but essentially there was the idea was that there was an arcade machine, and that when people played it, they would either, you know, have hallucinations, or they would, you know, have seizures, or some of them would die. And I always thought that this would be a really interesting, you know, seed of a story. And over the years, I tried writing several different drafts of movies involving this kind of core idea, but none of them really clicked. And then it was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when we were touring around with The Mind's Eye, and I was sort of revisiting a lot of Cronenberg films, and it just struck me one day, you know, I went, oh, this is how you can tell this story. You know, you make this a body horror film. And it just really kind of snowballed from there. You know, I wrote the script very quickly, the plot and the characters and everything really kind of flowed out of me. And I had an actual dream one night that involved and ended with seeing a melting skull like lit by Technicolor lights. And so I woke up and I immediately said, well, that's how I've got to put that in my movie. And so I wrote the script, and it wasn't long after that that I was at a German beer hall in Pasadena. I was there with my godparents, who both live out here in LA. They're both actors and producers. And they came to me randomly and they said, hey, we're looking to produce a film. Do you have any scripts that you want to direct? And I gave them this and they loved it. And something like 8 weeks later, we were shooting.
Wow. So it was a really quick turnover from script to into production.
Very, very fast, very fortunate, you know, really unexpected. But it was one of those things where it just kind of all the pieces fell into place right away. And everybody was, you know, on board, and everybody, you know, we were all in agreement on what kind of film we wanted to make. And so that just helped, you know, really streamline the whole thing.
Yeah. Having watched the film, you can definitely tell the Cronenberg influence there, but particularly the movies that I was brought to mind were Videodrome and Existence strong influences.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and another one that I really tried to implement as much as possible was specifically the relationship between Goldblum and Gina Davis in The Fly. You know, because a big part of Sequence Break between, you know, Chase and Bobby's characters, you know, is that their relationship blooms very quickly. And I really wanted to make that feel real. And in my opinion, you know, maybe the best love story ever committed to film is in Cronenberg's The Fly. I just think it works so well, and it's so eminently believable. So that was definitely a big influence as well.
Yeah, it seems like you made a real effort to make the characters quite grounded, because that relationship does feel quite real. It doesn't feel like a kind of, yeah, both characters, it's quite tender. You know?
Thanks. Yeah, that's, I appreciate you saying that. Yeah, I really, you know, for me, in order to have a successful horror film, well, I mean, a successful film really, but you know, especially with horror, you have to ground it in something, something honest, you know, and I mean, that can extend to a lot of things. I mean, that extends to like Evil Dead 2, you know, like even though that's a big over the top movie, like you wholeheartedly believe in Ash's plight, you know, and we're rooting for Ash, and that's what we care about the movie at all. And so I feel with Sequence Break, you know, what I really wanted to do, you know, because this movie goes to such bonkers places and has such like big ideas about it, that I really wanted to ground it in a believable, heartfelt romance. So I'm glad that came across. That was a really important thing to me.
Was there anything in terms of from script to screen, was there anything taken out or changed in any way? It seems like There could be a lot more backstory there to the game and the origins of the game, or was it always you were just kind of teasing that?
Good question. There was certainly some stuff that changed, you know, in the editing process. You know, like there were some elements of kind of how we structured the story that ended up getting changed pretty significantly in the edit. But everything that we filmed was pretty much exactly what was on the page. You know, as far as the backstory of the game, my intention was to tease tease elements of that, but not tell you outright, because I feel like there's a bit of joy to be found in the mystery of this machine. And you know, it's sort of similar to, like, gosh, what was the movie I was talking about the other day? Hellraiser. I was talking about Hellraiser. And there's something, you know, about Hellraiser where I like that we don't really know who the Cenobites are or where they come from or why they're there. You know, like, I like that it's left up to my imagination, with the full confidence that there is a mythology. You know, it's not just like they plop them down and they're, you know, just sort of like these monsters that are there for no reason. Like, I believe that there is a mythology back there. And to me, there's a mythology in there for Sequence Break for the machine. But I didn't feel the need to totally spell it out, because I wanted to let the audience, you know, have a little bit of something to chew on after the movie was over.
And in terms of once it was in production, how did the cast come together? Like, I know that you worked with Chase previously on Beyond the Gates. It was another fun flick.
Thanks. Yeah. I wrote the role, and honestly, Chase was the first person that popped into my head. You know, like, he's such a good actor, and I work really well with him, and I felt like, you know, Oz was such a sort of perfect vehicle for him. And so I reached out, and he fortunately was down. He said, yeah. And it was actually Chase that brought in Fabi, because Chase and Fabi had worked together on John Dies at the End. And we were sort of on the hunt to find a Tess, and Chase said, oh, what about her? And of course, I had loved, you know, I've loved her work, you know, in John Dies and in Southbound and all sorts of pictures. And so, yeah, she came in and read with Chase, and the two of them, of course, just have like perfect chemistry together. And so that was a no brainer. And then for the role of Jerry, that's actually my godfather, Lyle, who produced the film. He's a veteran actor, and has been in, you know, he's got hundreds of credits and he's been in tons of stuff. And, so that was also a no brainer of, you know, putting him to work. Cause I knew that he was going to be really perfect for Jerry as that sort of father figure to Oz. And then Johnny, who plays the man, you know, we auditioned, a lot of people, to play that role. And it was really interesting because we auditioned some much older people and much younger people. And, you know, it was sort of an interesting role to try to fill. And then Lyle had worked with Johnny before and, you know, brought him in to read, and, Johnny just completely nailed it. You know, he blew us away. He was sitting there weeping in his audition. It was just really powerful. And then the final character is of course, Audrey is the bartender, and Audrey is the other producer on the film, and Lyle's wife and my godmother. So it all worked out well, you know, you know, very, very fortunate to have found Johnny. I really think that he, you know, ended up tackling a very tough role, and doing a really great job with it. And Fabi was such a joy to work with, you know, and it was great to be able to put her and Chase on screen together, really bring that relationship to life.
As an actor yourself, was there ever any point where you thought, I'll put myself into, you know, it's your movie, you wrote it, you directed it. Did you ever think, oh, I'll act in it as well?
You know, for a brief moment, yeah, but I realized that, you know, with this being my first film and you know, really wanting to stick the landing on it, it's you know, but acting and directing are both very tough jobs, and I wanted to be able to give my all to directing and not feel like I was having to leave, you know, something else on the table, so that I could also do my job as an actor. Maybe in the future, you know, I could do that, but I didn't want to divide my attention like that. And I fully trusted Chase with being able to, you know, to carry the weight of Oz on his shoulders, and of course he 100% did.
As a, you were saying, it is your first film. How was the shoot? Was it difficult? Was it easy? I know you. I think you'd done like a short or something before, but this is the debut feature, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, all things considered, it was pretty smooth. You know, we went into it. My main thing with it was that I wanted to just surround myself with a crew and with department heads that all, you know, really knew what they were doing and were, you know, way better at me than, you know, at doing those jobs. And so we really just put a great team together. We shot the movie and I think it was 12 days. So it was a really fast shoot, but we were very well prepared. We went in every day knowing exactly what we had to get. And we did it. We made it happen. And obviously, you know, any shoot like this that's on a low budget and is, you know, done quickly is going to be a challenge and have challenging elements. But, you know, overall, I just think that our team was really great and we were blessed with a great crew and a great production team and a great cast. And, you know, when you have elements like that, you know, you've really set yourself up for success. And at a certain point, you just, you know, you let everybody do their jobs and the result is a really, powerful piece of work at the end. It was good. It was a great experience. And we were a family and I was just very, very thankful to have all of them, you know, in the trenches with me.
Do you think that being an actor yourself gives you any advantage in terms of communication and understanding with your actors on set?
100%. Yeah. Talking to actors about giving direction to actors is a really unique thing to each actor. And you know, having worked on a lot of sets and having been in a lot of casts, I feel like I've sort of seen the gamut of how different actors work. Some like literary references, some like being given objectives, you know, some really like to spend time and talk through stuff, you know, and so you sort of learn what each person responds to the best. As an actor, you know, certainly to never give a line reading or something like that. But you sort of know that the key to getting a good performance, in my opinion, is to give the actor a starting point of saying, this is what you want. You know, this is what your objective is for the scene. Now you figure out how you would get it and let them develop that from the inside out. And that's how you make something really true and honest and, you know, effective. Another element that sometimes bugs me when I'm acting in a movie is when, you know, a lot of time and energy is given to like a cool, interesting looking like camera shot. But then the dialogue is rushed through because we've run out of time because we spent so much time, you know, getting a cool looking like upside down angle on something. And I really wanted to be able to give my actors as much time as I could to act through the scenes and to let those moments breathe. And so that was something that I tried to bring as much as possible into our admittedly very quick schedule. But just to give them a little bit of breathing room to do their work.
I can certainly imagine that being frustrating. I can only imagine what it's like being on, you know, like a Terrence Malick film where you have to stand and wait as he gets a long shot of the longer, you know, fields of wheat and stuff.
Yeah. It's, you know, and that's part of the beauty of film, right? Is that as a medium, you know, it is all of those things needing to come together to work. I certainly learned being a director that there is some stuff where you need to, you know, maybe sacrifice a really amazing, you know, acting moment for something, you know, some really beautiful shot that, you know, that needs to come in at just that right time, you know? So I get that there is a give and a take there. But I tend to, you know, really, fall hard on the side of, you know, when you have great actors, like, let's watch them act. That's a magical thing. And, And so I really tried to give them that.
In terms of, I mean, obviously, because it is your first film, were you particularly careful in terms of the kind of crew that you got around you for the shoot?
I mean, yeah, you know, I've been very lucky to have worked with some really amazing crews on, you know, other films. And so I was able to, you know, reach out to people that I knew were all stars, you know, that I'd worked with and that I trusted, you know, like Brian Sowell, was my DP and you know, he and I have worked together on a number of films now. And you know, I just knew that he and I got along really well on a personal basis, and that, you know, aesthetically that we had similar, you know, similar likes and dislikes. And I knew that he just really knew what he was talking about. And so that was a really, you know, he was a real blessing, because I could, you know, I could say something to him like, oh, you know what I want that visual effect, like they have in Punch Drunk Love, you know, and then he'd go figure out how to do it. Or like, oh, I want this to look like The Void in Under the Skin. And he'd go, you know, figure out how to make that happen. And so that was a real blessing. You know, Josh and Sierra Russell, my special effects team, love those guys. They're incredible. You know, and their work is just really beautiful. And I, you know, had total confidence in letting them just, you know, run with it. You know, really, I mean, I could go down the list. I mean, the whole crew was just really perfect. And fortunately, I mean, pretty much everybody that I asked to do it did it, you know? It was, you know, just very, I was very lucky.
It's interesting, you know, just with the references of the film, you know, we've talked about Videodrome and Existence and the Fly and the Cronenberg stuff, and you mentioned Under the Skin there, and very much the kind of, yeah, the black group that she rises up in, that's very kind of Under the Skin. There's a bit in the movie as well where he's the arcade machine, like the wires come out and start wrapping around them, and I was wondering if that was a reference to The Evil Dead, because it felt like kind of like the tree scene in The Evil Dead.
Bingo! Congratulations. Yes, it was.
Totally. That's good. Did I win a prize?
yeah. It totally was. I mean, you know, I wanted. I mean, yes. You know, I wanted. You know, in the script, I think it's written like, you know, the cables come out of the machine and wrap around him. You know, but then when I was trying to figure out how to actually implement it, you know, the first thing I thought of was, oh, well, you just do reverse acting like in The Evil Dead, you know, like that's how you do it. And it's so effective in Evil Dead. And I really love how it turned out in Sequence Break. But yeah, that was 100% our visual reference for that moment.
Excellent. So when the movie came out, how did the, it obviously became a Shudder exclusive. How did that come about?
Gosh, I mean, I don't know all the mechanics of you know, how it got into their hands, but, you know, obviously I have through the many years of being in different films, you know, I got to know Sam and Colin and all the folks over at Shudder. And so yeah, they watched the film and they liked it. You know, it's as simple as that. I was so grateful, you know, like I respect them so much, and I've really, you know, loved what Shudder is doing from the very beginning. I've been a customer of theirs since, you know, day one. And I was just thrilled, you know, when they said that they'd watched it and that they'd actually liked it. You know, you always hope that the people that you respect and admire, will like your film. But that's never a guarantee. You know, but they watched it and they liked it and decided to get it. And you know, I couldn't be happier. It's such a great, you know, home for out of the box, you know, horror cinema. And I think that the audiences at Shudder, really appreciate, you know, people, you know, making bold moves and trying to do different things with their horror. And so the response has been really nice, and I've just been very thankful that we've gotten to be a part of the Shudder family.
Also, Sequence Break is obviously a very 80s influenced film, and we mentioned briefly Beyond the Gates, which is another very 80s influenced film. Is that kind of your favorite part of horror? And what's
yeah, good question. You know, I feel like right now we are having a big, you know, sort of 80s horror renaissance, largely because the filmmakers grew up in the 80s. You know, when we try to emulate and are inspired by the things that we loved growing up. And so I think that that's a lot of the reason why, you know, filmmakers like me and Jackson and, you know, and all of us are, and Joe, you know, are really drawn to that era. You know, I'm not sure if I'd say it's my favorite. You know, I really respond well to, you know, like 70s horror. There's a big, you know, for a while, I had a really big love affair with, you know, like early, like the old Universal Monster movies. I think there's some really interesting stuff that happened there. I mean, Night of the Hunter is one of my favorite films, and that was made in, gosh, what, 50-something?
55, I think, yeah.
You know, and so I think that there's a lot of really, you know, interesting horror kind of throughout the decades. And what I think is most interesting is when filmmakers try to draw from all of those, you know, to tell stories now. But I mean, yeah, I love 80s horror. I mean, I was a VHS kid, you know, every weekend we'd go to Blockbuster and, you know, I would just go scour the horror aisle looking for something. Something to rent, and fortunately my parents were okay with me watching horror films when I was like 12. I really like all of it.
And you're still a fan of like the kind of modern day up to the present horror as well?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I mean I really I mean, gosh, you know, I guess this is perhaps more sci-fi than horror, but like, you know, I just saw Mike Doherty's Godzilla King of the Monsters. I really enjoyed it. I'm very excited about Midsommar, which just looks, you know, totally terrifying. I think that Jordan Peele is really doing some interesting stuff right now. You know, between Get Out and Us, you know, and of course those are the more mainstream things. I mean, I you know, talking about Shudder, like Shudder has some really incredible films, that, you know, are more below the radar. I mean, I think like, like Terrified, the Argentinian film, it's just really wonderful. I think I'm not sure when it's coming out, but I saw Issa Lopez's The Tigers Are Not Afraid 2 years ago. Yeah, 2 years ago. At a Morbido Fest in Mexico City.
I heard a lot about that. That got like really good reviews when it played at Fright Fest, and I didn't make it to Fright Fest last year.
It's really powerful. Really powerful film. It's I mean, it'll wreck you. You know, it's a tearjerker. But it's really, really powerful filmmaking. And I think that that's just sort of indicative of kind of the, you know, the horror world right now, is that there's just really awesome artists that are now kind of have the freedom to take chances and take risks and tell, you know, interesting stories through a genre lens, you know, partly because, you know, the mainstream is beginning to sort of embrace horror, you know, a bit more. I hope.
But, I would say so. I think there's been a kind of run of films that seem to have got kind of critical praise and ended up in mainstream press, like It Follows, The Babadook, Get Out, Hereditary, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting. I mean, I suppose that, you know, you could have said the same thing about like the run of like Silence of the Lambs and Seven and, you know, kind of those films too. Of course those were, you know, all called thrillers, you know, which I disagree with, but, it's just sort of an exciting time to be a horror fan. I feel like, you know, like I saw Brightburn the other day, and although like there are problems with the movie and I understand people's complaints about it, it was just really cool to me to see, you know, this film that's out on like 2000 screens, that's very violent and very dark and, you know, is sort of under the guise of being a superhero movie, but is like really intense, and that this is something that is out, you know, in cinemas nationwide. It's I think an exciting prospect for what's to come.
Yeah. I think maybe more people are kind of sneaking in under the radar in the mainstream. I mean, obviously Brightburn got such a massive release because it's produced by James Gunn, who, you know, because he made the Guardians movies, even though he started out as like a trauma director. You know?
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, there seems to be more people kind of sneaking in there.
Yeah, I don't know. It's fun. It's cool. And I like that, you know, last weekend I could see Brightburn. This weekend I could see a Godzilla movie, you know, Variety is, you know, writing, you know, pieces about Ari Aster's new film. It's just, there's a lot of attention that's coming to it. And I think that just helps kind of trickle down to, you know, to the small guys, you know, having an easier time getting funding for their, you know, even stranger films.
It's interesting. I've not caught Godzilla King of the Monsters. Yeah, I do like Godzilla movies, but I've not seen it yet. It's interesting. You seem very positive on it. I've heard very mixed things. It seems to have got very
I have too. I mean, to be honest with you, I feel like, well, one, I admittedly am a pretty forgiving moviegoer. I like a lot of stuff, you know, and it's very easy for me to not care about, like, you know, I don't know if there's a character whose acting is not as good or if there's a plot hole. Like, there's a lot that I can kind of look past and still enjoy the film. I don't know. I think that people are looking at this new Godzilla movie, like, with a bit too critical of a lens, you know, and that, like, certainly, you know, like, if you watch the original Godzilla, you know, from 1954, I mean, that's a masterpiece, right? And that's, like, something that you know, deservedly is a Criterion release and you know, has a lot to say about society. You know, in this one, I feel like, you know, if you're going in expecting that, you're going to be disappointed because nothing's going to reach that height, you know. But if you go in expecting a fun time at the movies, which is what I wanted, I totally got that.
And then, yeah, and sometimes that's all a movie needs to do. Like, not everything has to be a masterpiece. And, you know, sometimes you want something that's just purely entertaining.
Yeah. I'm totally content with just being entertained by something. You know, that's not easy to do. It's very, very hard to make a movie. And it's especially hard to make a movie that is, you know, that's legitimately entertaining. I think Mike Doherty did a really great job.
As well as, obviously, as well as your directing Sequence Break, you seem to be keeping yourself very busy acting-wise as well. I know that you're in a movie called Bliss that seems to be doing a lot of horror festivals now, and you're in another of Joe Bagus's films that's, I believe, in post-production, VFW. Is that how you've worked a lot with him? You're in like something like five of his films, I think.
Yeah, I've been. Yeah, I'm joined at the hip to Joe Bagus.
Is he just a director you really like working with? I take it you're friends.
Yeah, he's one of my best friends. I mean, I think the two of us really kind of came into our professional lives in the horror world together, you know, like Almost Human was really, you know, a huge rite of passage for us both. And I think it took a tremendous amount of trust on Joe's part to give me that role. You know, and Joe, you know, I mean, he's never steered me wrong. He and I get along really well. You know, we speak the same language. He writes me great roles, and he's always just been really, you know, he's a very loyal guy. And in this business, you know, that can be something, you know, really hard to find in a collaborator, is the kind of loyalty and true, like, heartfelt friendship like Joe and I share. But yeah, I mean, I love working with him. I totally get, you know, it's almost unspoken at this point, like, the type of direction he gives me. You know, I know what he wants. I know the way that he works. And I'm just really lucky that, you know, he keeps wanting me on his team. I would, you know, I'd do anything for that guy. I really, I owe him a lot, and I just really like working with him.
I've seen I've not seen it yet, but I've seen a little bit of Bliss. A coverage of it, and it seems like an interesting movie.
It's pretty wild.
Also, I mean, we've been talking a bit about the 80s and, you know, way back when, and his latest picture that's is in post, I believe, VFW, it stars a whole bunch of kind of genre stars from the past, like David Patrick Kelly, William Sadler, Fred Williamson, Martin Cove, all that. How was it acting with those people?
I mean, it was incredible, you know, like just to be in the room with all of them, you know, it was really powerful, you know, and each of them is certainly a personality, but they're all very kind, all totally professional, you know, and just to see all of them work was a huge lesson for me, you know, and just how to, I don't know, how to be on a set, you know, like the epitome of class. And, you know, every single one of them, so kind to everyone, you know, didn't matter if it was, you know, Joe as the director or a PA, you know, just everybody very, very kind, you know, there to do their jobs and do it well. Each one of them, you know, totally unafraid to get dirty and really, you know, get down in the muck with everybody else. It was just really inspiring, you know, and as a big fan of each one of them, you know, just hearing the stories and keeping my ears open, you know, was half of the time there, you know, just letting them talk and sort of basking in being around them. It was really, really special. I was very grateful for that opportunity.
Was it difficult at all in terms of, you know, when filming, to kind of take off your fan hat and put on your professional hat and be like, look, there are other actors. I'm just going to act beside them.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I mean, you know, ultimately, you know, when the camera starts rolling, like especially with guys like that, you know, you're there to do a job, you know, and it was, so it was really easy to just immediately fall into, you know, I'm gonna act the hell out of this and I'm gonna be totally in the moment. And, you know, at that point it didn't matter. You know, I was just opposite a different character, you know, like to see Stephen Lang switch from being himself off camera to, you know, to being his character. It you know, he's all in, and by God, I better be all in too.
Yeah, it's interesting because you don't know what these people are like. You just, I just know them from the movies. So I kind of always imagine somebody like Stephen Lang being, I don't know, quite a gruff person. But then again, that's just the characters he plays, not necessarily the person that I have, you know, because I have no knowledge of that.
Yeah, totally. No, and that's part of it. You know, each of these guys, you know, for the most part, you know, they played such intense like people in other films. And so getting to meet them in person and just like sort of chat with them, you know, it's you're just reminded that, you know, everybody here is just a really talented actor, you know. And they're, you know, they're playing a character just like you are. It was just really cool and inspiring to be able to be in that room, you know, even briefly. It was very cool, and I learned a lot.
Of course, on Beyond the Gates, you starred alongside another famed genre star, Barbara Crampton. Was that fun as well?
Oh, the queen. I love Barbara Crampton. She's amazing. She's become a dear friend. She she was, you know, from the get-go on that film, was one of the, you know, biggest supporters of the film. You know, she produced it as well. Her leadership on set, and just her, you know, general, like, very just kind approach to everyone, you know, it set such a good example and such a good sort of tone for the rest of us to follow. But yeah, Barbara is a magical human being. And I would love to work with her on a thousand things. She's a really special person.
And how did you end up on that film? Was that something you auditioned for, or is that something else that you kind of know the director,
Jackson? I had known Jackson. So I first met Jackson because Jackson had been an assistant to Stuart Gordon before I met Stuart and started doing Reanimator the Musical. And so Jackson, I guess, was around. He had seen the show, and then he asked me to do a short that he had written, and you know, we got to know each other from there. So he just asked me to do the role of Gordon. And of course I read the script, and you know, what I told Jackson was, you know, this is a really, it's a rare sort of chance, you know, to have a good meaty role like that. And Gordon, I felt was a really, you know, interesting role with a lot of heart to it and a lot of, you know, a lot of subtext to play with. So I was very grateful to be a part of that. But yeah, it was purely through, and same with how I met Barbara. Everything goes through Stuart Gordon. That's how I met Joe too.
Wow. And how did you, well, let's circle right back to the beginning. How did you first get into acting? And
oh gosh. Both of my parents were actors. My dad was a professional actor. You know, he used to do like soap operas and things like that. And growing up, like my whole family was very involved in like, you know, the local community theater, and that was just always a really important part of our lives. And I went to college for acting in New York City at Fordham University, and got a theater degree there. And then primarily what I did in New York after that was I founded a theater troupe, and we did live comedy variety shows that you know, covered everything from, you know, we did Chekhov and magic acts and dance numbers and all sorts of crazy stuff. It was through doing the comedy work that I met George Wendt, who of course is
from Cheers.
I
know he starred in those things, bro.
He's most famous as Norm from Cheers, and he had just come to see our comedy show, and he became a good friend and did a couple of guest spots on our show with us, and became a pal. And it was him that recommended me to audition for Reanimator the Musical in LA, because of George's Chicago connection with Stuart Gordon. And so that was really how it happened, you know? And so I just came out, I was living in New York at the time, and I came out and auditioned for Stuart, to play the role of Herbert West. And fortunately he liked me and I got cast. And that was really then how I met everybody in the horror community. I mean, I met Joe Bigas that first day because Joe was stage manager on the show. That was how I met Joe. I mean, that was how, I was introduced to the entire horror community because they all came to see the show. The horror community here in LA is just very supportive, of each other. And so that, you know, being a part of that show, I think really led to me being invited to be a part of other projects, and, you know, just sort of gave me a home in the horror world, which is something I was very grateful for.
That's interesting. Having talked to a number of different people on the podcast, a number of different horror directors from different places, be it here in the UK or in Canada or in the States, quite often you seem to find that the horror community is quite supportive. You always think of the kind of filmmaking community as being maybe a little bit cutthroat, but horror seems to attract people who like want to the other people to, you know, do well as well.
Yeah, you know, I feel like everybody that makes a living, you know, doing horror specifically, makes that choice because they at some point in their lives were a total weirdo that felt ostracized and just liked what they liked. And I feel like all of us, you know, and that was certainly me, and I feel like all of us, you know, now that we have found some level of success doing this weird thing that we used to get made fun of for, we band together. And it's, you know, we all want to see more good horror in the world. So it doesn't do any good to shit on somebody that's doing their thing. Like, let's support each other. Let's make sure that more good horror exists, because we're only doing this because we're fans. You know, it's like I can't imagine somebody that, you know, doesn't like horror, doesn't care about the genre, that is begrudgingly, you know, making a living making horror movies. Like, what a horrible existence, you know?
Yeah, I know.
It's So I think it's just because we all really genuinely like it, and that may not be true in other, you know, genres. You know, like that it may, that may be a different scenario, but I can't speak to that, but I know that with horror, you know, we're all, I think there's just generally a sense that we're all in this together.
You mentioned your relationship with Stuart Gordon, and I don't know, you never know if these things are true, but on the IMDb trivia of Sequence Break, it says that you ran an early cut of Sequence Break by him and also Neil Marshall. Is that true? And
yeah.
What feedback did you get, and did you make any changes based on that feedback?
Yeah, gosh, that's funny. I didn't know that was on an IMDb trivia for that. That's great. Both Neil and Stuart came over to my house one night and I showed them the movie. And you know, their main note, that both of them gave, which really was something that I took to heart and that I did, you know, take into the edit, was to really not be afraid to focus on the love story. You know, that this is, that I can't remember exactly what the words were, but it was something to the effect of, you know, you're leaning really heavily right now into all of the weird body horror stuff, but we're missing some of the love story, and it's the love story that we ultimately care about. And so, you know, don't be afraid to, you know, even if you sacrifice some of the body horror stuff, to lean into their relationship, because that's really the meat of the story. And that was a really great note. And it was totally accurate. Yes, I was really, I was just sort of, you know, grinning ear to ear as a fanboy, you know, watching the both of them sitting on my couch, watching my movie. I was very, very thankful for that.
And how do you know Neil?
Gosh, Neil first, I met him when he came to see Reanimator the Musical. That was the first time I met him. And then I think he saw it a number of times, actually, after that. And then eventually invited me to be part of his segment on Tales of Halloween. And so that was how, you know, how we became friends. And I really cherished that friendship, and, you know, have really enjoyed, you know, watching his amazing, you know, success with things like Game of Thrones. And, you know, that's just been really fun. But he's a great guy, and obviously very, very talented. So very, very happy to call him my friend.
I obviously you took their advice to heart, because it comes through that, you know, the focus on the relationship between and family's characters, for sure. I also, because talking about Stuart Gordon as well, I noticed that you're on a kind of YouTube radio show called Suspense. I was thinking of the Lovecraftian thing, and one of the characters you voice is H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah, I got to, that was a real pleasure for me to get to voice old Howard Phillips. That's a really fun project. That's a resurrection of an old radio show from, gosh, like the 20s or 30s. That was also called Suspense. And John Alcidek has resurrected it. And I've been lucky enough to get to be a part of a few of them. They're all really fun. I'm not sure where you can listen to them now. I know that they've been archived somewhere. I'd have to look that up, but that's a whole, like, sort of different, really fun style of performance, you know, of the radio play, that I really enjoy getting to do. It certainly stretches a different kind of muscle.
Yeah, yeah. How is it different from, like, acting, movie acting?
I find, for me, that I fall into a trap where, because I don't have, like, my physical features to help me sell a moment, right? So I don't have my eyes or, you know, my intense face or whatever. And so I find that I start to, like, or at the beginning, I would, like, generally overcompensate with my voice, and then it would come across as, like, vast overacting. And so the challenge for me was to be able to rein it in and have it be natural, and to find the sort of necessary intimacy that I think you really have to have with a radio play. You know, I mean, you're for all intents and purposes, somebody put it to me this way, and this really, you know, rung true, is that for all intents and purposes, that microphone is your audience member's ear. So you are right there with them. And so you've got to be able to channel all of the emotion of the moment into just that breath, you know, in the inch between your mouth and the microphone. And that just takes a lot of control and a lot of, control really is the best word, to use for it. But it's really fun. And the other fun aspect is that you can do a lot more with radio than you could ever do live. You know, like you can describe a tentacle beast and have like, you know, squishy sounds happening. And it's just as real, you know, if not more real than if somebody were to try to put it into a film.
You definitely seem to like to keep yourself very busy. Yeah, it seems looking down your IMDb, it seems like you've tried every different aspect of filming, be it writing and directing there and editing, several acting credits and different types of acting as well, voice acting, movies. I take it that you like it that way, just having lots of things, lots of irons in the fire.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you kind of have to be that way in this business. I have always been somebody to never want to feel complacent, I think I also just really enjoy getting to work, you know, and if the work isn't being given to you, then you have to create it for yourself. And you know, that was something that I learned at Fordham, you know, when I was in college, and something that I've really tried to bring with me throughout my professional life is that, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, to be auditioning for jobs and getting jobs and getting hired for stuff, but it's a whole other thing to, you know, when you're not doing that, then you've got to be making stuff for yourself. And I just try to always do that. You know, if I don't have a job I'm working on, or even if I do, I'm always thinking about what's the next thing, what's the next, you know, what's the next step for me? What's the next job I want to do? What's the next kind of performance I want to do? You know, like with Rated R, it was the same thing. It was like, oh, this seems like a really fun project, you know, and I feel like a lot of times it's very easy to kind of go, yeah, that would be fun, but that'll be really hard, or I'm really busy, or I'm really tired. And instead I just go, yeah, it's going to be fun. Well, it's going to be worth it. You know, once it's all said and done, no matter how tired I am or how hard it was, then taking that bow at the end of the night it makes it all worth it. And I just kind of keep that as the light at the end of my tunnel is, you know, when one day when I leave this earth, I want to leave behind a whole slew of things that I was involved with that either people can remember or people can watch or, you know, people can, you know, share stories about. You know, that's a really sort of special thought to me and kind of drives me to just keep doing stuff always.
And how do you, like, what makes you pick a project? I mean, like, I'm just looking at the titles, I noticed you've got, like, you've acted in three films that are in post-production, and one of them is called Hipsters, Gangsters, Aliens, and Geeks, which is a fabulous title.
Yeah, you know, how I choose a project depends on a lot of things, like, if I know the filmmaker, you know, there's some filmmakers that I just automatically want to work with, you know, so it doesn't matter what they're doing. You know, it's like with Hipsters, Gangsters, Aliens, and Geeks, you know, the director of that is Richard Elfman, who is best known as, you know, he was a founding member of Oingo Boingo. And he also, you know, directed the vastly underrated Forbidden Zone, which is one of my favorite weirdo movies of all time. And you know, so when Richard Elfman asks you to do a film, you do it. You know, and then other projects, you know, it's people send me scripts, and if I respond to the material, then I'm game. You know, it's really a matter of just kind of looking at what the project is and what sort of character I have the ability to play. and then whoever the filmmaker is, you know, and that's sort of the criteria, you know, and if I think something's going to be fun, and if I have faith that the product is going to be good, then yeah, let's rock and roll.
And currently, are you just happy acting and doing your stuff with the Rated R Speakeasy Bar, or do you have a second directorial project in mind?
Yeah, I have a few directing projects that I'm trying to get off the ground right now. I would definitely love to direct again. And I have a few irons in those fires. It takes, I've learned for sure that getting a movie made is way more difficult than my first outing was. It takes time and it takes patience. And but I've been working towards that, and I hope that soon there will be some kind of news about what that next project's going to be.
But you can't tell us anything right now.
Sadly, I cannot.
That's a shame. Do you see that taking the front role, or do you always want to act?
Oh, I always want to keep acting. I mean, I like to say that I want to always do it all, and I want to just provide myself with as many opportunities as I can to keep doing all of these different things that I love. And, you know, moment by moment, you put focus into, you know, whatever thing is the most pressing or the most vital right then. And so, you know, one year it might be, you know, I'm only directing, and then the next year maybe I act in 5 or 6 movies. I hope I do. But it's just a matter of always being open to new opportunities and trying to stay in the, you know, stay in sort of the general public eye so people remember you're around. and most important of all is just work well with others. You know, I really enjoy, you know, working with the filmmakers that I've worked with, and you know, I like to think that I'm, you know, pretty good about, you know, I show up, I do my job well, I'm easy to work with, I'm on time, you know, all those things that you know, sort of add up to just being, you know, an easy, cool person to be on a set with. And so I just, in everything I do, I try to be consistent with that. And so I hope that leads to, you know, people wanting to work with me in whatever capacity they want. So yeah, I want to do it all. I'm greedy.
Well, excellent. Well, I have to say, I mean, it's been great chatting to you, and good luck with all your films you've got in production as an actor at the moment. Good luck with the Rated R, the special screening of the Child's Play. It's an apocalypse, and all that, and whatever the project you're trying to get directing next.
Thanks, I appreciate it, and yeah, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed getting to talk to you guys, and please go like have a dram or something for me. I miss Scotland so much. I really want to get back there as soon as I can.
We shall do. We'll have a dram on your behalf.
Fantastic, that makes me happy.
That was my guest Graham there, and in case you're wondering, yes, we did have that dram. It was a nice Lefroy that I happened to have in the house. Not as a plug or anything, but if Lefroy did happen to be tuning into the show and fancy sponsoring a Scottish horror podcast, then they would be welcome to get in touch with us on our very public email, info@newhorrorexpress.com. Although, for legal reasons, I should point out that other whiskies are available. Go out there, try them all. That's what we suggest on this podcast. Talking about getting in touch, though, similarly, if you are an indie horror filmmaker, novelist, actor, whatever, don't be afraid to get in touch. We love to talk to anybody working in indie horror today and shine a light on the very best talent working in the indie horror industry right now. However, we have come to the end of another episode. That is all for now. We would recommend, before we head on out, that you rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, on Radio Public. Also, you can check us out on Spotify. We're everywhere. We're
wherever good podcasts are available, we are there. We've also got a Facebook page. You can hit us up on that. You can hit us up on Twitter at New Horrors EXP. Yeah. Anyway, please be sure to join us in 2 weeks' time in another episode hitting you in a fortnight's time, where we will have another great guest for you. Until then, though, see ya.